Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Southern Rivers, Restoring America's Freshwater Biodiversity by R. Scott Duncan. Narrated by Danny Hughes. Men may dam it and say that they have made a lake, but it will still be a river. It will keep its nature and bide its time, like a caged animal, alert for the slightest opening. In time, it will have its way. The dam, like the ancient cliffs, will be carried away piecemeal in the currents. Wendell Berry, The Unforeseen Wilderness, 1972. Preface. The Southeast is unique for its astonishing diversity of freshwater animals and the exquisite beauty of the rivers in which they dwell. The region's streams range from rocky creeks in the headwater valleys of the southern Appalachians to the muddy behemoths that grind across the coastal plain in their migration to the sea. Maps highlighting the concentration of freshwater taxa on the planet, fishes, turtles, snails, mussels, crayfish, aquatic insects, and others, reveal that the Southeast harbors more aquatic species than most other places on Earth. The people of the Southeast depend heavily on their rivers. Rivers provide electricity and drinking water. They are used to ship freight and irrigate crops. Rivers are the destination for beloved traditions such as fishing, tubing, and even baptisms. And yet, like with rivers throughout the world, we use southeastern rivers to dispose of treated sewage and industrial waste. When it rains, the region's rivers overflow with pollution from urban and agricultural landscapes. Many southeastern rivers are so polluted, their fish are unsafe to eat. Despite their economic and cultural importance, rivers are invisible to most who live in the Southeast. Mountains, deserts, and oceans command attention, but rivers slink by unnoticed. They sink into the landscape, veiled behind curtains of forest or guarded by no trespassing signs. Most people only ever see rivers through windshields from bridges. It takes an act of pilgrimage to stand beside a creek or river. This invisibility must end because southeastern rivers are in crisis. I began writing this book to celebrate the river biodiversity of the Southeast and the Herculean efforts by scientists and environmentalists to ensure it survives. While there are formidable challenges to species conservation in the Southeast, I was optimistic about the future of these rivers and their species. In recent years, scientists have made great advancements in the fields of ecology and species conservation, and I wanted to share these inspiring successes. But as I began my research, my optimism began to wither. I had been unaware of how industrialized southeastern rivers were and what the consequences were of this degradation. Then I read the latest climate change predictions for the region. Droughts, water shortages, sea level rise, stronger hurricanes, and species extinction. The Southeast is facing an environmental crisis unlike any other in its 30,000 years of human occupation. These revelations shook me. I am native to the region and its waters. I was raised on the shores of an estuary, where river water mingles with the ocean on every tide. During a half century of life in the Southeast, I had grown to treasure the region's biodiversity, landscapes, and people. Now, I was worried about the region's future. That was when this book took on a weightier purpose than I had initially conceived. It became a journey of discovery, a quest for hope about the Southeast future. I wasn't sure what I would find. I am pleased and relieved to share that I am optimistic again. It is not a shallow, everything will be fine optimism. It is a calculated optimism. We have all that we need in the Southeast and globally to change how we live with nature and one another, so that humanity and biodiversity enjoy a secure and prosperous future. I am convinced we can do this. Building a better future begins with understanding the scope of the challenges we face. To that end, in the first half of this book, we explore the Southeast's environmental history as it relates to rivers. Stories of challenge, hardship, inequity, and loss provide the context and lessons needed for pulling out of the downward spiral of ecological deterioration and its cultural and economic consequences. In the second half of the book, the journey continues as we discover the technology and ideas needed to manage rivers and water resources better, create a more secure future for ourselves, and revive river ecosystems and biodiversity. Perhaps the most important lesson I share is that the needs of humanity and the rest of Earth's biodiversity are now inseparable. We cannot thrive without biodiversity, and biodiversity cannot survive without us. We live in mutual interdependency. To apply this lesson to rivers, people the world over need healthy river ecosystems to provide clean drinking and irrigation water, and to sustain coastal lands and fisheries. Rivers do their best at providing these and other ecosystem services when their native species are present and their populations are strong. Where rivers have lost their biodiversity, people drink polluted water, harvest less food, and suffer more flooding. On the other hand, the future of river biodiversity, indeed, the biodiversity of the entire planet, now depends on humanity's choices. We have assumed the job of managing the biosphere, that razor-thin layer of the planet supporting all life. Consequently, millions of species now depend on our next moves. Will we destroy the last strongholds of biodiversity and thereby condemn ourselves and all future generations to ecological poverty and resource scarcity? Or will we adjust how we live so that humanity and biodiversity thrive side by side? This time, right now, will be one of the most important in the unfolding of the human story. If we want a future of security, hope, and prosperity, we must begin making smart, strategic decisions about how we choose to live with nature. The experts say we have just a few years to get this right. The work to build a better future will be done locally. It's in our own communities where we will adopt the practices that help us overcome the social and environmental challenges we've created. In the Southeast, much of this work will involve re-engineering how we think about and live with rivers. And the sooner we begin, the better. Part 1. 1. The point. Knowledge empowers, but right now, it feels like a curse. I've returned to one of my most sacred places. I find footing on the rubble and lift my head. This spot is the exact boundary between Pensacola Bay and Santa Rosa Sound, two estuaries of the Florida Panhandle. The journey, our journey, begins here. A mountain creek or a river shoal would also be logical. But this place, my childhood playground at the terminus of a watershed, it feels right. I usually come here to enjoy the view and wildlife, and am never disappointed. Today I am encircled by sunlit waters rippling with activity. A sheep's head crunches on barnacles. A young stingray glides along the bottom. Mullet meander along the margins of the rubble, while young male dolphins frolic offshore. This location is the westernmost tip of the Gulf Breeze Peninsula. On maps, it is Fairpoint, but in my family, we simply call it The Point. My parents live nearby on land that's been in the family since the late 1800s. The Point is sacred because when I was a child, it was part of my everyday life. I was here often, usually alone, beachcombing, crabbing, fishing, or snorkeling. Behind the Point's beaches was a coastal oak forest and a scattering of old wooden cottages. In those woods, I built forts, hunted for treasure, and led epic expeditions. I break from watching the dolphins and scan the horizon. Landmarks greet me like old friends. To the northeast is the Pensacola Bay Bridge, stretching across 3 miles of open bay and humming with cars headed to the outer beach. Pensacola's waterfront spans the north horizon. A huge red ship is at port, and to its left is a cluster of large white fuel tanks. With a squint, I can see the oversized American flag at Joe Paddy's Seafood next door. Farther west is the low-lying shoreline of Warrington. My dear friend Anne lives there, on land that's been in the Forster family since 1909. On a clear day, I can see her house, safely elevated on pilings. Due west from where I stand, at 3.5 miles distance, is Pensacola Naval Air Station, the cradle of naval aviation. To the south is a horizon free of obstruction, save for a narrow line of dunes stretching westward and nearly out of sight. That strip of sand is Santa Rosa Island, and its westernmost end, free of apartments and condominiums, is part of Gulf Island's national seashore. For me, one who longs for natural landscapes, this portion of the panorama is my favorite. Today I am not at the Point to relax. I'm here to confront the anxiety that now manifests whenever I visit. When I was a child, the Point was a wonderland. Now I see this place through the eyes of a middle-aged biologist who has studied ecological changes for 3 decades on 4 continents. Here at the Point, I see threat, instability, and symptoms of the environmental problems I now study. It's during reflective moments like this when my knowledge feels burdensome. Take, for example, biodiversity loss. When the owner of the Point died in 1998, the land was sold to developers. The forest and cottages were unceremoniously scraped away and replaced with a gated community of large houses, precisely manicured lawns, and exotic tropical plants. Witnessing the loss of my childhood playground was wrenching. Paradise lost for me and my family. Paradise found for our new neighbors. In the great scheme of things, the loss of the Point's natural habitats is inconsequential. But centuries of accumulated micro-losses like this are how we've created an extinction crisis. Death by a thousand cuts. More ominously, the Point itself is disappearing. Today, at its tip, I stand on concrete rubble. When I was a child in the 1970s, the Point was surrounded by beach. When my father was a child, the Point was a driftwood-strewn sand spit stretching a half mile into the bay. The spit and the beach are gone. The rubble on which I stand was dumped here in the 1940s. A first attempt at preventing more shoreline loss. The shoreline is receding elsewhere in the estuary. Farther up the peninsula, stately slash pines are toppling into the bay, cluttering beaches with trunks and root tangles. Pleistocene bluffs, capped with remnants of the scrub oak ecosystem, are being devoured by increasingly hungry storm waves. Waterfront landowners, including my parents, have armored their properties with walls of wood, metal, and rock. These are symptoms of sea level rise. one of the greatest threats humanity now faces. Signs of water quality decline are also here at the point. A few yards from where I stand, the yellow sand gives way to seagrass meadows. When my parents fished here as newlyweds, they could land a dozen speckled trout in an hour. But in my youth, my mother and I would cast here for hours and never get a strike. Today isn't much better. One reason is that the meadows are shrinking. Throughout the Pensacola Bay estuary, seagrasses have declined to less than 10% of their extent in 1950. Here at the point, a once continuous meadow is now a chain of irregular patches. Normally, Pensacola Bay is a clear water estuary with a visibility of 6 to 7 feet. On this day, the waters appear fine. But after any heavy rain, bay waters swirl an ugly brown, sometimes for weeks at a time. These sediments block the light needed by seagrasses and plankton, cutting off the base of the estuary's food chain. Higher in the estuary, dead zones caused by pollution form each summer. These are expanses of water devoid of the oxygen needed to maintain aquatic life. Some creatures flee. Others sicken or die. And then there are the toxins. PCBs, dioxins, arsenic, cadmium, and copper. These and other carcinogens were released liberally into the bay until the early 1970s. They persist as legacy pollutants, troublesome toxins that degrade slowly or not at all. They lurk in the sediment and are resuspended in the waves when strong storms cause turbulence. Wildlife absorb the contaminants, and the toxins grow increasingly concentrated as they ascend the food chain. Popular species of fish and shellfish, including striped mullet and blue crab, can carry these toxins at levels where frequent consumption increases cancer risk. I fear this problem more than most of the others. When I was a child, mullet and crabs were staples of my family's diet. We'd catch the fish from our dock, clean them, and bait crab traps with the heads. One night's dinner was fried mullet. The next night's dinner was boiled crabs. This is still a beloved and frequent ritual enjoyed by my parents, my wife and children, and my brother and his family. I have eaten thousands of mullet and crabs. My parents have eaten tens of thousands. This is no exaggeration. We've done the math. How much PCB and dioxin are in our bodies, lying in wait like little mutagenic time bombs? How many in the Pensacola region who regularly eat mullet and crab from the bay have been stricken with cancer as a result? How many have died? And who is next? This is what I mean when I say that knowledge can feel like a curse. Wherever I go, I see symptoms like these that indicate ecological decline and growing environmental insecurity. However, for years, I didn't understand the connection between all these problems. They were localized and independent of one another. The toxins were a result of chemical spills long ago. Coastal erosion was caused by changes in the bay's currents due to dredging, bridges, and seawalls. The muddy waters resulted from poorly managed agriculture and construction sites. Now I know better. The problems in Pensacola Bay are connected through cause and effect. What's more, they are part of a pattern found in nearly all estuaries of the southeastern United States, including Mobile Bay, Apalachicola Bay, Charleston Harbor, Pamlico and Albemarle Sound, and Chesapeake Bay. The litany of ailments is daunting. Land loss, dead zones, pollution, collapsed fisheries, invasive species, harmful algal blooms, and toxins in seafood. What connects all these problems? It is how we manage our rivers. Abundance of fresh water is the Southeast's greatest natural asset. Take away the rains, rivers, aquifers, and humidity, and you would have a dry landscape hostile to most forms of life. Food would be hard to grow. drinking water would be expensive. Instead, water is abundant. Life in the Southeast prospers with ease. The region overflows with biodiversity. The natural landscape is green and lush. Water is so abundant that most of us who live here never worry whether our taps will run dry or our lawns will stay green. Rivers concentrate this liquid asset into dependable positions in the landscape, and while we lack the knowledge and technology for complete control of our oceans, the climate, or Earth's shifting crust, rivers can be mastered by human engineering. As a result, rivers are now essential to the southeastern economy. We extract and clean river water, then pipe it to our homes and businesses for drinking, cooking, bathing, and flushing away waste. Pumps slurp water from rivers to irrigate crops and water livestock and poultry. We hoard river water behind dams and release it to generate electricity. Coal, gas, and nuclear power plants extract river water to use as a coolant or as the steam that spins their turbines. River water is used to rinse coal mined from the Appalachian Mountains and carry away our stormwater, treated sewage, and industrial waste. We've also reshaped rivers for our convenience. Creeks have been diverted, piped underground, and paved to guide them through our farmlands and cities. Big rivers have been dredged and straightened for commercial shipping. Dams have been built to transform river valleys into waterfront property and havens for recreation. River floodplains have been lumbered, delta marshes have been ditched and drained, and wetlands have been filled to create dry land for agriculture and urban sprawl. These are all examples of river industrialization. I do not use the term industrialization in the traditional sense to mean a society's transformation from an agricultural to a manufacturing economy. In this book, I instead use the term more broadly to indicate a society's use or transformation of nature, including plants, animals, minerals, and landscapes, in the process of building or protecting economic security and wealth. This includes the commodification of nature, but also the resulting generation of waste and wasted ecosystems. My use of the term also includes the modification of nature to provide security, such as the building of a levee to prevent flooding. All this river industrialization has brought tremendous prosperity and opportunity to the Southeast, but it has also created a nasty tangle of unintended consequences that are costing us in prosperity, health, and human life. Because river systems are the liquid arteries unifying our landscape, problems in rivers do not stay local. Fresh water is increasingly scarce. Urban sprawl is causing dangerous flooding. Nutrient pollutions feed algal blooms that threaten human health and damage fisheries. Waves on popular southeastern beaches churn with silt after heavy rains. River swimming holes and coastal beaches are monitored for fecal pathogens from sewage leaks and overflows. State governments routinely warn people, especially children and women of reproductive age, to limit or cease their consumption of popular freshwater and saltwater fishes due to toxins. These and the signs of ecological decline I see at the point are all blowback from our industrialization of rivers and their watersheds. We can do better than this. We must do better than this. This is why I'm at the point today, at the very bottom of a watershed. It's the start of a journey, a quest for a better grasp of what's happened to the southeastern environment, especially our rivers. Researchers have completed a tremendous amount of science on the southeastern environment in recent years. They made discoveries in biodiversity, ecology, conservation, hydrology, and climatology. There are even breakthroughs in environmental justice and economics. Not only do I want a deeper understanding of these subjects, but I want synthesis. I want to understand how we got here. I hunger to see how all the parts fit together. But more than anything else, I must know whether there is reason to hope things can get better. Because knowledge shouldn't be a curse. 2. Welcome to the Anthropocene. Just how bad is the environmental crisis in the Southeast and beyond? River industrialization, and the good and bad that come of it, is a global phenomenon centuries in the making. The practice is nearly universal, and by some measures, the Southeast doesn't have it so bad. Shockingly, about 25% of the world's rivers are like the Colorado River. They are tapped dry before reaching the coast. Others have been hopelessly polluted, even to the point of extinguishing all but the hardiest life forms. What we've done to rivers is one part of planetary industrialization. The rivers, oceans, lands, and atmosphere are now under significant human influence. In recognition of this, scientists have coined a term for the new era, the Anthropocene. The geologists formally proposing this as a new geological age describe it as a time interval marked by rapid but profound and far-reaching change to Earth's geology, currently driven by various forms of human impact. The concept immediately clicked with me. The advent of the Anthropocene epoch marks the end of the Holocene epoch, the previous 12 millennia during which Earth's climate was well-suited for human needs. Prior to that, during the Pleistocene epoch, humanity endured a series of brutal ice ages. Punishingly cold temperatures kept us in a hunter-gatherer cultural phase. Human culture flourished when the planet broke free of the ice ages and entered the mild and stable Holocene. The benevolent climate fostered our development of agriculture, complex civilizations, and advanced technologies. The seeds of the Anthropocene were sown in the Industrial Revolution, which began in the mid-1800s, when we developed modern machines and new forms of producing energy. Through a series of breakthroughs, we massively amplified our ability to shape the world. And we have been tremendously successful. We number in the billions and have settled across the planet. We produce an abundance of food. Medicine has reduced suffering and mortality. Civil order is largely maintained by law, not force. Education, music, art, literature, and performance have proliferated. Travelers, goods, and ideas crisscross the globe every second of every day. Humankind's collective knowledge is available to billions through the World Wide Web. Sure, we have a long history of violence and oppression, and there's still far too much misery, injustice, and conflict. But life for the average human is far more secure, comfortable, and interesting than at any time in recent millennia. The result of this success is that our impact on the environment upscaled from the local to the global. No place on the planet is unsullied by human influence. We've converted all the easily inhabitable portions of our planet into managed forest, pasture, cropland, and cities. No less than 75% of Earth's land surface has been significantly altered, and 2/3 of the world's oceans have been affected by pollution and the harvest of marine life. Only 15% of the world's wetlands remain. Even the most remote locations have lost biodiversity, been subject to resource extraction, or felt the far-reaching influence of our pollution. These trends show no signs of slacking. For example, between 2010 and 2015, humanity cleared an area of forest greater than the size of New Mexico. The idea that humanity had initiated a new era began surfacing in the late 19th century. However, the concept did not receive much attention until the final decades of the 20th century, when global change scientists began detecting a strong human influence in data from around the world. By then, the global impacts of rapid
sample complete. Ready to continue?